Welcome to the Down to Earth podcast, where we talk to advocates, artists, neighbors, scientists, and anybody using the creative process for the humanistic force it is for ongoing growth, originality, and meaningfulness. Through informative discussion, Down to Earth will shine a light on the Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens and the Kenilworth area's past, present, and future, with a sharp focus on the climate emergency and its intersectionability with systemic racism. My name is Julianne Brienza, and I am the Executive Director of Capital Fringe, and I am joined today with my co-host, Bakari Ibrahim of Candor Labs, and our guests today both serve on the Board of Directors of the Friends of Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens, an organization that Capital Fringe has been working closely with on Down to Earth. Justin and Dennis Chestnut. Bakari, are you ready to start our journey?
I am very excited to have this conversation today. We've been talking a lot about, you know, what's been going on in Ward 7 and how the environment has been affecting the Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens and the community there. So I'm actually really excited to learn from our guests today. So let's get right into it.
All right, let's get started. Let's meet our two guests and learn how they got into organizing and advocacy in their community. Justin, let's start with you.
Certainly. Well, I'm Justin Leaney. I'm not a DC native. I grew up in Monroe, Michigan. It's a little industrial town on the banks of Lake Erie. Funny enough, Monroe is known for its American lotus flowers, which grow in the marshes along the lake. It's actually an area not all that different in some ways than where we're at in Ward 7 and Kenilworth Parkside. And sadly, like our neighborhood, people have a complex relationship with, when I was growing up, people had a complex relationship with nature and the water. Monroe had a culture of boating and fishing that went back centuries. But on the other hand, everyone knows the history of Lake Erie and its struggles with environmental pollution. And when I was growing up, it was just recovering. In some ways, I see similar relationships with that. I see that we have a similar relationship with the Anacostia River and Kenilworth Park here in Ward 7. That's sort of where I come from in my background. And I came to the district in 2007 to study at American University as a graduate student. And my wife and I fell in love with the city and stayed afterwards. We lived in a little cramped apartment on 8th Street for several years before deciding to make DC our home permanently. And we looked around and we chose Ward 7 because I'd been a Red Cross volunteer for a couple of years, and I had gotten all around DC responding to house fires. And every time I'd come to Ward 7, what I saw is people always came out and were supporting each other and really what's sort of people's worst moment of their lives. And I realized that was this kind of community that I wanted to be a part of, which led me here. And then I took a trip to the gardens, or my wife and I took a trip to the gardens, and we knew it was home. So after coming to the community, I got involved with my local civic association, really just to make some friends and get to know the community. And I made myself useful by doing some volunteering. And not long after, people started asking me to do more and more. For example, our advisory neighborhood commissioner was retiring. He had done several terms, and that's a job that can wear you out. But no one was offering to take the position. And I had a few neighbors ask me, and I said, oh, no, I'm brand new here. That wouldn't be right. I don't know enough about the community to really do a good job representing it. And I probably would have went on declining until Ms. Geraldine Bell, our Civic Association president and really one of our community elders, sat me down one day and asked me to do it. And when someone like Ms. Bell asks you to do something, you really should listen because she knows. So that's how I ran for office and really kind of how I became an activist. I got to know my community by talking to everyone who would talk to me and listening to what they had to say and reading everything I could find. I learned about my community's history from people like Dennis, for example. who lived it themselves. And I also plunged into every report and document I could find on the environmental issues, transportation issues, everything. I knew that I lacked the background and roots in the community that other people had. So I knew I had to do my homework in order to represent it and be a part of it.
All right, thank you, Justin. I just want to acknowledge the wisdom that you shared with really the resource that a lot of our elders in our community can give us in really frank language and direct engagement, which has been my experience in DC as well, the knowledge that was shared with that, and also just the power of having to educate yourself about certain issues, because not everything is spoon-fed to us. All right, Mr. Chestnut, we would love to hear about your story of becoming an advocate.
Yes, well, my name is Dennis Chestnut. I am a native Washingtonian and a lifetime resident of Far Northeast Ward 7. I've lived in Washington, D.C., in various parts of Washington, D.C. after I became an adult and got married, but I wound up back in Ward 7 after my father passed, and my mother didn't want to stay in the house, in the home by herself. So my wife and I and our family took the house over rather than put it on the market. And that was back around 1980 that happened. So I've been living here in Ward 7 in my boyhood home since 1980, along with my family. My parents came here in the 40s, in the 1940s, in the early 1940s from South Carolina. And they both are from South Carolina. And my father, most black folks that came to DC, it was a big migration from the South, of course, that was taking place. My father came first, and the part of town that most folks were gravitating to was the U Street corridor, the area around Howard University and that particular area, because it was very prominent for the African American community, businesses and other things. But he really didn't like that area, and he discovered the Hillbrook area of Ward 7, where we live now, which is off of Minnesota Avenue. Near the Nanny Hall and Burroughs corridor, or what a lot of people know as the Deanwood neighborhood. And he really liked it, because he, as we began to talk about it later, he told me, he said it reminded him of South Carolina. So this part of Far Northeast Ward 7 was considered at that time rural. It was kind of like a suburb of the city. I remember even up until the mid 1960s. Well, really, it was towards the latter 1960s. Up until that point, this part of Washington D.C. was not even, they didn't have a street grid listed on the street maps for this part of the city. Once you crossed the Anacostia River, it was a solid color area over here. You know, so it was. It was really considered on the other side of the river for a long, long time. As I said, I moved back into my boyhood home here in 1980, began raising my family. And that was when I began really, I would say, getting involved with civic kinds of things. I mean, I was exposed to, you know, the environment as a young person. Just growing up in this area, you couldn't help it because of the way that the area is wooded, is close to the river, we have streams. I mean, it's really, a very environmentally rich area as far as those things are concerned. And of course, I, played outside and and that was my exposure to those things. But as I began raising my family and I began, my children began to grow, I started seeing things and seeing needs that I had to get involved with to help move along. So that was really the beginning of my civic activity. Very simply, kind of like Justin, going to civic association meetings. Because I was very well known in this area by a lot of people who lived here, it kind of thrust me right into the middle of a number of things. And fortunately, I had been my parents, my family, and I also grew up in the church here in Ward 7. And it was naturally an opportunity to be involved and be active because there was just so much that needed to be done. So I started, you know, by becoming a civic association representative for the community, and then moved into actually starting a nonprofit organization to carry that work further. So that was really the beginning of my civic engagement, and I've been at it ever since. I'll be 72 years old on my next birthday next month, and you know, it's really I'm really enjoying seeing kind of the fruits of the labor, so to speak.
Thank you, Dennis. Well, let's get to, I don't know, maybe the biggest fruit tree that we're dealing with, which is the cleanup of the Kenilworth North Park, which is an issue that through the Down to Earth program, many of the artists we have selected are using that and learning about the long history of the federal government's management of the site with the potential transferring it back to the district after the, whatever the cleanup ends up being exactly. And so I was hoping that Dennis, you could, just because it is a very complicated issue that we could probably talk for 2 hours, 3 hours on, if you could just for our listeners do a little sort of recap of sort of the history of that dump and where we are today with what the community, how the community can have their voice heard or how the community's voice is being heard in the process.
Sure. Well, one thing that we have to keep in mind, and when I have these discussions with people, it's very important to understand the time periods that certain things happened, because those periods had a direct impact on what was happening and how they were happening. For example, just one thing I'll just put out for everyone to understand. Washington, D.C. was under total federal control as far as governing up until we got home rule in the late 70s. You know, so up until that time, the federal government, not just National Park Service, but the federal government controlled everything. They, the city was run by three appointed commissioners appointed by Congress and the president, and they ran the city. And so what that did was that made this part of the city, which was already as I described earlier, the other side of the river, or, you know, some people like to use the analogy, you know, how they say, you know, when you're on the other side of the tracks, you know, things are a little different. Well, we're actually located on the other side of the tracks as well, because the railroad tracks run complete, the railroad line rather runs completely through, you know, this area as well. So this community developed as pretty much a very resilient neighborhood and community, because we had to do, for the most part, most things for ourselves. Now, you have to also layer that with the fact that Washington, D.C. is a southern city. And segregation was a part of the way D.C. operated. But that, you know, that impacted a number of things. And that really is one of the things that led to, you know, why this landfill or dump, as it's known, you know, is located in the area of number one, right along the edge of the river, but also in an area where primarily lower income and people of color live. So not just the local environment was dumped on by locating this landfill where it is, but also I really look at this community was dumped on, and what happens on the land directly affects what happens to the river, but also what happens on the land affects the all of the inhabitants of the area, everything from wildlife to the residents. So the Kenworth dump was located here, and it was the municipal dump for Washington, D.C. Everything came here. I mean, when you name it, it came to that Kenworth landfill. It was a number of things to a number of people. When I was a child, it was even a playground, because we didn't have a recreation center up until, like the mid-60s. They started locating recreation centers on this side of the city. But, it was for a youngster, you can imagine, it was a great place to explore. You found all kind of neat things in there. Of course, it was dangerous, but, to a kid, danger is relative, and so it did a couple of things. It was an environmental hazard for the local community, because up until a tragic incident that happened in the just before the landfill was closed down. A tragic situation where a child died, and they had open burning of fires. They used to move all of the debris up into piles in various places around the dump, and then they set them on fire. And the soot and smoke from the fire would saturate the entire community from as far as I would say 3 to 5 miles, people would be impacted by soot and debris that would settle in their communities. I know my father used to wash his car sometimes. As a matter of fact, he was scheduled a car washing because he liked to have his car clean to go to church on Sunday morning. But they used to do a lot of burning on Saturdays. So he would wait until later in the evening after, most of that was finished before, he would have my brother and I go out and help, of course, to wash the car, to get it cleaned up. So it'd be cleaned up for church the next day. And if you can imagine, if this soot and debris was settling on cars and on, it's a number of things. I remember people hung their clothes out after washing, they had clotheslines and that was one of the other things that was impacted by that open burning. And then air conditioning. I mean, we did not have air conditioning. We had fans and screen doors, and in the hot months, folks would open those and, to get ventilation. And of course, you had to close your windows and doors during the burning period so that you wouldn't be blowing all of that soot through your home. And it definitely had to have some impact on the health of you know, of the residents too. Very high incidence of certain cancers wound up developing in River Terrace and some of the bordering community neighborhoods that bordered Parkside, Kenilworth, that bordered the landfill. So, you know, describing it as a very, you know, it wasn't a good place, but, you know, there were active residents in the area. There was a very active group of women in the Eastland Gardens neighborhood. They had a garden club for one, but they were just active, and they would protest, you know, that burning at the landfill. They would, you know, block and impede the trucks from coming in to dump at times. I mean, it was, you know, and a lot of these things, you know, became aware, you know, through our local newspaper, the Washington Afro-American and things of that nature. So, no, it was, you know, it was pushed back on it, but it took that tragic incident to the young man's name was Kelvin Mock, who was caught up in one of the fires and died tragically as a result. And I think that was the final straw that caused the landfill to be shut down and to begin to be remediated in the way that it did. So now, you know, of course, the whole Kenilworth Parkside area has a tremendous history. And the Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens, of course, has a tremendous history. You know, the original Fowler was a former Civil War veteran and wound up settling there. There was, it's really a very interesting history. Folks should check it out sometime. And see the legacy connection between all of it, especially how it's impacted this local community.
Okay, so Justin, do you want to comment on the CERCLA process that's going on right now with the federal government? And just so that our listeners can know what, you know, this has been going, I'm correct that this current process started in 2000. So if you can kind of talk us through the CERCLA process that is happening now.
Sure thing. And I invite Dennis to jump in too, if I invariably miss something. So the dump was capped in the early 1970s, really before environmental regulations had come online that sort of mandated the way you should do that. So the cap on the dirt that was put over the site had some features missing that they have had since, such as features to prevent water from entering into the materials from the environment and various other features like that. So it had been covered and used as recreation space for several decades. There's sports fields there, even there now. And really in the current process began in the early, late 90s, early 2000s. At Kenilworth South, where some landfill dirt was brought in to sort of raise the level, put a digital cap on, and they were going to originally build more sports fields there. There were problems with that process where the oversight was limited and materials were brought in that were inappropriate. It was a lot of construction debris. So they had to clean that up. And that space really never became active recreation space again. So if you go there now, it's kind of rewilding. It's turning back into a forest and it's beautiful. In Kenilworth North, however, the federal government began a cleanup process, which is really to this point involved collecting a significant amount of data and engaging in dialogue with the community over the last two decades. I believe it really kicked into high gear around the beginning of the 2010s with some dialogue in the community about what the future of the site should look like in terms of the cleanup. And I think the Park Service, from what I've read, the Park Service encountered some pushback from the community, because I believe they wanted to sort of cap everything and tear down a lot of that rewilding that was happening in the South End. And community members spoke up and said that that was something worth preserving, actually. So the Park Service has been back to the community on several occasions since then to update the community on their findings, testing the groundwater, testing the threats to the community from contamination in the soil, and really starting to clarify what exactly the risks are and what potential transit pathways are for chemicals to leach out of the landfill and into the environment. It's been a long process, but now we're reaching to the part where we're getting to a record of decision, which says this is going to be what the parameters of the course of action are going to be. During this process, Congress passed a law that would transfer control of Kenilworth Park North, which is a very large piece of land, from the Park Service to the District of Columbia government. One of the challenges in executing that law, that was 2006, one of the challenges in executing that law was that the district did not want to accept control over that ground until it had been, the pollution issues had been settled. So this, you have the space that's kind of been in a little bit of limbo. The Park Service isn't going to have it there forever. District of Columbia isn't going to do anything with it until it's cleaned up. And it's under very strict regulations about what you can do with it, because it's a national park and it's the same types of regulations you have for a park like Yellowstone as you have for kind of what is an urban park in a neighborhood. So we're finally getting to the point where decisions are going to be made about what this cleanup is going to look like. And Park Service came out to the community last year with a number of alternatives, ranging from doing nothing, which is sort of the default for any of these engineering projects, to removing all contamination from the soil and restoring it to the native tidal wetlands that were there, which would be lovely. And then in between, there were several steps where they put more dirt on it to cap it, or varying levels of that. The Park Service is inclined to through its process is sort of inclined to a position where it puts more soil on some select areas to ensure that active recreation is safe. And then really kind of rely on monitoring and what they call institutional processes. That's different, you know, signage and that kind of thing to keep people from being exposed to the contamination. And so the current step we're at right now is the Park Service is accepting comments on this. And then I think over the coming months and next year or two, I think the discussion will turn to what exactly the details are going to be on this and how this cleanup is going to affect the community and what exact areas are going to be remediated versus what's going to be capped versus what's going to be left alone. And there's a lot of discussion right now about how this interacts with what the District of Columbia wants to do with the site going forward. Department of Energy and Environment and DPR both are starting to think about what the future of this area looks like, especially in light of issues like climate change, which is a direct threat to communities in Kenilworth Park side from sea level rise to flash flooding. One of the things in the community we really worry about, want to make sure we protect ourselves from, is ensuring that nothing we do there makes it more difficult to mediate the effects of climate change. Dennis, is there anything you think?
Sure. Yeah, a couple of things. One thing that's very important. There's been some milestones that have happened along the way. since the process started. And one of the things is there's been a good level of stewardship and community building that have taken place that has really helped with engaging the community in the process, which is very important because we're just concluding, as a matter of fact, today, a comment period that was really extended as well from the original 30 days. So we're concluding the comment period where stakeholders have been able to provide their comments, get questions answered, question the Park Service, get some details, clarification, all of those things. And so that's ongoing. That record of decision is very key because that's kind of like the contract, you know, that says what will be done. And then the how it will be done part of it will be able to be worked out with the DC agencies once that initial remediation is taken care of. One of the milestones that has taken place in the process is demolition of the Pepco transmission plant, which is on the south end of Kenilworth Park, and what has been a contributor over the years to a lot of the pollution, to the river and to that immediate land area that's bordering Kenilworth Park. So that coming down has been a major accomplishment, and it helped, I think, engage the community even more and kind of kickstart some things and some focus about Kenilworth Park. And of course, one thing I do want to point out to the listening audience that Kenilworth Park, the Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens, are all part of Anacostia Park. Anacostia Park is the park that runs from the very southernmost end of the Anacostia River in DC, all the way to Prince George's County. There's parts of Anacostia Park in the Bladensburg area, and the tributaries from Northwest and Northeast branches feed into that as well. So it's really a park that is parallel to the Anacostia River, and it just so happens to be kind of broken down into a few smaller segments, and one is Kenilworth Park and the other is Kenilworth Aquatic Gardens along with River Terrace Park. So we're at a very important point right now in the process, and once this record of decision is made, that is really what's going to move the process forward and have the remediation begin, which I'm really looking forward to. Hopefully we can see that concluded as little as maybe 5 years. I'm going to be ambitious about that, and hopefully we can look at that kind of time frame. But what it really will boil down to is for the community and the stakeholders to stay engaged and continue to push the envelope, so to speak, and make sure that the cleanup process is done the way that it's supposed to be, so that we won't have to revisit this again like we're doing now 50 years later. We won't have to revisit this again because of a inadequate capping process. So just wanted to add that.
I want to thank you both it is a complicated issue that has, covered decades. And I know in my own educational process on the issue, which I've lived in DC for 18 years, and I didn't really start educating myself on this issue until about April of last year. And when I look at the issue and the process that is outlined for the cleanup. And then I add the layer of sea level rise, which will actually impact that, you know, that part of our city, you know, in 9 years. I sort of reverberate Dennis's, you know, last sort of statement on, let's not have to go back and do this 50 years from now. Because something that Dennis said in a previous time when we talked was that, you know, we have had a lot of progress, and we have more tools, I think, now to do things correctly. So to bring it sort of back to advocacy and how you have that in your lives, I think it's probably clear from anyone who's listening to this that this is a passion. This is a dedication. This is a lot of reading of, you know, government documents and, you know, things that maybe you have to read a couple times to thoroughly understand. I wanted to ask you if in your life you listen to a certain type of music or music that really kind of spurs you on to continue this dedicated sort of investigative and service to the community. Justin, do you want to share first?
Sure. There's a couple different types of music I listen to. So if I need to concentrate, I definitely listen to something quiet and kind of generally classical piano music. So, you know, in particular when I'm trying to concentrate, I like Erik Satie music. Although I think there's other times though where I just need a pick up. And so I kind of go back so when I was a kid, my mother would go to swap meets and collect these little singles records from the 60s and 70s and 50s. The ones that I always liked the best were Motown music, you know, being from that part of Michigan, and soul music. So I think back to 2017 when we had a whole bunch of these comment periods that we had to respond to quickly. And I was working to put stuff together. And the music I was listening to then was a lot of Curtis Mayfield. And in particular, Move On Up was my song that would get me going. And that was kind of the music that I grew up with a lot. So that's kind of what motivates.
All right.
Yeah, wonderful.
All right. How about you, Dennis?
Yeah, well, my favorite music is jazz. I was introduced to jazz, you know, not really, no one was really introducing me to it, but it was being played, you know, in the house. So, you know, you wind up, you know, becoming associated with it and listen to it and begin to enjoy it. And as I became a young adult, I really you know, got into the jazz. I mean, one of my favorite, I would say my favorite jazz artist is John Coltrane. Justin, I came of age in the 60s, and Motown, of course, was the music, you know, of the time. One of my, you know, is one artist and one genre of music that I'll listen to if I, you know, really want to be motivated, and that's Marvin Gaye. And especially that classic album that he put out, in 1970, I think it was basically the anthem for the environmental movement, you know, when he put out that What's Going On. Of course, I was very involved with the development of a park that is just on the other side community, just across from the Kenilworth and Parkside community, where we were able to get the park named Marvin Gaye Park. And the main tributary to the Anacostia River runs through that park, Watts Branch. So, what's going on? Mercy, Mercy Me, Ecology, Marvin Gaye. Yeah, that really is. And I concur with you, Justin. Curtis Mayfield is special music. That's special music there.
All right, thank you both for sharing that. I think both Macari and I are like, yes. I know, like in my own work, music very much motivates me, and it ebbs and flows depending upon what I'm working on. All right, well, I think we are kind of wrapping up our first Down to Earth episode. Right, Macari?
Absolutely. This has been an amazing conversation. Just learning about the Kenilworth North environment, but also that history and that timeline. I'm a Ward 7 resident myself. I actually purchased a home in Ward 7 last year. And learning about the environment and just learning about this history, I think is important as, you know, new members of the community, you know, stake their homes here, and we'll constantly see these changes of people coming in. So with that in mind, and with that learning that we've taken on today, what call to action do you have for our listeners to get involved and move forward? And what resources can we look towards to support the movement and the remediation of the space?
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that I do get an opportunity to talk to a lot of new residents to Ward 7. Because of being involved, I'm involved with a couple of different projects that, you know, puts me in touch with some community members. And also young people. When I say young people, I teach part-time, I teach high school as well. But I really impart for them to keep in mind that there were things that were going on and happening prior to them. That, you know, I say that because I was in a meeting and a new resident was in the meeting, and he made a comment that drew my attention. You know, he said, you know, I moved in over here. I forget, you know, he was recently, you know, purchased a home, moved in, and it's terrible over here. Nothing is going on. I mean, why is it looks like nothing's been done? And that, you know, of course, my brow got wrinkled. And, you know, I said, first of all, I asked him, I said, well, if that's the case, why did you buy over here? But the other thing was, I said, no. And I started, it gave me the opportunity to point out some things. For example, Nanny Helen Burroughs Avenue, which is the first green infrastructure project, Green Street in Washington, D.C. It was a model. They have stormwater management features that are now being replicated throughout the city, even in parts of Rock Creek Park. And it was because it's you know, it had some of the challenges, but it also was a great place to pilot some of what the city was looking to do along those lines. So I caution folks to, you know, just learn about, you know, the community, learn about what, you know, what had happened, what it was like, and then look at all of the progress that we've made over time. But the main thing to keep in mind is we can't sit on our laurels at any point along the line, because as we finish our immediate tasks, we still have to labor hard to make sure that things are sustained going forward. And so, you know, that would be the main message I would give to folks, you know. And also keep in mind that the human beings are not the only residents of this community, and especially of these areas that we're talking about. The wildlife is there. It was there before we came in, and it's there now. And when we do the things that we do, we have to keep, you know, the wildlife, you know, keep that in mind as well as we, you know, make our decisions about what we do.
Yeah, Dennis has really touched on some really, really great points. And I think I'm probably a little more succinct because I don't have as much to say. But you know, my big message is to be a part of something. I think so many people want to go and do something good and help out. And I think so many people feel like they've got to do it alone. And you don't. And especially in a community like Ward 7, where it's a tight-knit community, I think it's really key to sort of belong and to get involved and to get to know each other and listen. Listening was a key and is a key aspect of my advocacy in the community. It sort of requires you to understand that you don't know all the answers, and you have to be a little humble because people will teach you a lot if you listen to them. And like Dennis said, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I've been in meetings before with folks like that. And it always sort of makes me chuckle because everyone comes in and thinks they're the first to sort of say this thing. But really, I think the key thing is, you know, to move beyond that kind of initial hot take reaction. And do it together. This kind of advocacy can wear you out and exhaust you, or it could also be really rewarding and fun. And I think the key thing in that is how you engage with others around you and work together. I think some of my fondest memories in life are helping people prepare to go talk to DC Council. It seems like something kind of boring and something many people would run away from, but you know, that sense of camaraderie and working together is really, really valuable. And really, I think helps you sustain for the long, long haul on these kinds of issues, which took decades, centuries to make and will take decades to fix.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Well, we will share just some additional resources as we get this podcast live, just different Facebook groups that our listeners can join and just some other documents if anyone wants to dive deep and educate themselves on how they can become involved. As this, you know, I kind of going back to a couple of things that were said, especially with you, Justin, when you said that, you know, you first came to DC and you weren't really sure how to get into the, you know, if it was your community. And I think in my process and working on the Down to Earth program in Ward 7, I have had moments where I'm like, well, I don't live in Ward 7. I live in Ward 6. But the more that I have educated myself, I realize that this isn't just a Ward 7 issue. This is a DMV issue. This is an issue about how we repair our past and protect our future, I think. Mm-hmm. And so this is a community issue and not just a neighborhood issue. So I hope that our listeners will dive in, follow along. And I want to thank both of you for your time today and the sharing of your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to speak and share, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Down to Earth. Our next episode will be recorded in April. We will be focusing on sustainable fashion, and our guests will be Christina Brooks Cooper from the DC Fashion Foundation, Janice Wallace, a creative consultant and curator with a focus on building a sustainable wardrobe, and Nikki Hendricks, our spring Down to Earth residency artist, who is designing a sustainable line of clothing inspired by the nature of the Kenilworth area. Happy spring.